Two, the present mood of the American people, created by so much fear and resentment at the way taxes have risen to such an oppressive height in just 5 or 6 years under the Nixon administration, makes such an educational program in this field more timely and realistic than ever before. And what we need most to bring about some gradual but increasingly beneficial results of such a program is to convince more and more of the American people of just two things. A, that no such astronomical revenue from taxation is actually needed by the federal government at all. And B, that this whole trend to ever more exorbitant and ruinous taxation without such need or justification is being deliberately promoted by insiders of the master conspiracy for destructive purposes. Three, the second of these aims is particularly within the province and, we are sorry to say, almost exclusively within the activities of the John Birch Society. Not long ago, your speaker this afternoon had the pleasure of attending in Washington a dinner in honor of that great American, and incidentally a member of our council, Dean Clarence Mannion. The 500 people present included 6 or 7 conservative senators, about the same number of conservative congressmen, scores of top-level military men, and other leaders of very, very varied backgrounds and connections in patriotic American activities, and was described from the podium as being the most prestigious gathering of American conservatives that had ever been assembled in one room at any time. There were many short preliminary talks by those at the head table, followed by a long and excellent major speech of Senator Jesse Helms, and then by an equally able and serious response from the guest of honor himself. And I agreed with everything they said. But, ladies and gentlemen, I most assuredly did not agree with what they didn't say, with their omissions. For well over 2 hours, we listened to some superb delineations of what is wrong in our country today and what ought to be done about it. But not once during that whole time did we hear the words conspiracy or communists even mentioned. At one point, Dean Mannion listed the forms of government, including socialism and communism, to which our present trends lead. But with that single exception, there was no slightest attention paid to the crux of the real problem at all, which is simply that all of these horrible things now happening to us have been planned and plotted to happen and are being steadily advanced to more horrible and incredible extremes by the communists and their bosses above them, whom we call the insiders. This attitude, my friends, is not only a mistake, it is the biggest mistake being made by conservatives as a whole today, and with few exceptions for the past 30 years. And it is exactly what the insiders want. As we have pointed out before, the communists are absolutely sure of winning if all of their opposition can be kept on an ideological plane. They are so sure of this that their liberal angels will even subsidize your opposition to them and help it to grow if you still fight them only in an ideological and political terms. Because under those conditions, they can throw into their side of the scales, on top of their ideological arguments and propaganda, all of the secret pressures, dirty tricks, and vicious crimes, which are the main part of their strength and their strategy. This is how they still make everybody, or almost everybody, think that they are winning more and more power and prestige through increasing public acceptance of various ideological features of their program. It is imperative, therefore, that the John Birch Society and all of its most dedicated members take the lead in pointing out the hands and plans of the conspiracy at work behind so many destructive movements that are underway. The drive, for instance, to enforce the idiotic busing of children away from their neighborhood schools, supposedly to overcome racial imbalance, is not due in the final analysis to either misguided idealism nor political demagoguery, even though both of these skillfully induced attitudes are cunningly utilized by the insiders to put their nefarious plan into effect. Racial justice, friendly coexistence on truly equal terms, and such social intermingling as may be actually desired by both races is the last thing on earth that these conspirators really want. What they are after is exactly the opposite, namely all of the bitterness, resentment, distrust, and even militant hostility by ignorant and gullible hotheads on both sides, which this busing scheme can help to bring about. Very similar considerations apply to all the present activities of conspiratorial plotters behind the scenes to demoralize, discredit, and stultify our local police forces. The real objective of the insiders, of course, through all of these methods and means which we have been forecasting for years, is to facilitate their establishment of a national Gestapo. You can find parallels to these tricky schemes in a dozen other fields of activity, from welfareism here at home to our subsidization of communist phonies calling themselves social democrats or by other misleading names all over the world. And above all, you will find the same principles true with regard to the taxation now being imposed on American industry and the American people. So it behooves all of us, Birches, not only to call a spade, with regard to who and what is behind all of these terrible things that are happening to our country, but to apply that rule with special emphasis in connection with taxation. Use your own knowledge and experience and do your own research to whatever extent is practicable, while making sure that you turn to sound sources for such digging, and absolutely sure that you have your facts correct and your interpretations reasonable in everything that you write, quote, or otherwise expound on this subject, as of course on all subjects. And making equally sure ourselves, we should try to be of more specific help to you when and after we get this project called Lower Taxes Through Less Government officially underway in our July bulletin. 4. This brings us to a most distasteful series of paragraphs which we feel obliged to insert into our present monologue. It is a warning that not all of the, quote, literature, unquote, being issued by some of the tax revolt advocates is entirely dependable. We do not intend for this to be a slur at all on the leadership of the tax rebellion as a whole. There are quite a number of smart men behind this movement, and everybody that we know to be supporting it is a patriotic American. But let us illustrate the concern we are trying to ventilate here by referring to a pamphlet, which we shall call Overkill, not its name at all, written and published by a man whom we shall call Mr. Y, which obviously is not his name at all either. Now, even if we used Mr. Y's right name, most of you in this audience would never have heard of him. Some would, but most of you wouldn't. But he is fairly well known in some sections of the country. This particular pamphlet, one of a periodical series which he has been publishing for years, contains 24 pages, 8.5 inches by 11 inches, printed mostly in about 9-point type. In its 20,000 words, more or less, there are many sound arguments against the tax tyranny that is afflicting all of us with increasing severity every year. But the reason why we have dubbed this pamphlet Overkill can be brought out quickly in this very brief review by the following example. On page 17, a supposedly important paragraph begins with these two sentences, quote, "Many do not know that the Liberty Bell was not first rung to celebrate our political independence from the King of England. It was first rung 20 years earlier to proclaim financial independence from the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England," unquote. Now, it is true that the Liberty Bell, brought over from England, was recast in Philadelphia in 1753. So it could easily have been rung in 1756, 20 years before our Declaration of Independence, in celebration of some patriotic protest or activity of the kind that eventually led to the American Revolution. But in 1756, my friends, the time when this man said that the bell was rung in protest against the control of the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, controlled in America, in 1756, Meyer Amschel, founder of the House of Rothschild, was a boy 13 years old. It was still 45 years before even Meyer Amschel was to receive any official recognition of importance, even at home, by being appointed financial advisor in 1801 to the Landgrave of Hesse Castle. The one of his sons, Nathan Meyer Amschel, who eventually founded the family branch in England, and therefore did eventually have some influence with the Bank of England, Nathan Meyer Amschel was not even born until 1777, 1 year after our Declaration of Independence and 21 years after the date when, according to Mr. Y, the American colonists were proclaiming their, quote, financial independence from the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, unquote. It was largely to prevent such wild statements and incredible distortions of history on the part of our fellow compatriots in the anti-communist cause that we republished a few years ago Count Egon Corti's superbly detailed and documented history about the rise of the House of Rothschild. For in due course, the sons of Meyer Amschel were cooperating with each other very closely, while each one was established as an important financier in a different country. Thus, they began to set the pattern of working on both sides of all wars, which policy has since become so important a part of the strategy of the whole conspiracy. By 1815, Nathan Rothschild had indeed acquired a powerful influence with the Bank of England, and the other brothers were also prospering mighty well in their respective areas. And by the time the Rothschild brothers had survived the insurrections and disorders of 1830, which the conspiracy itself had fomented, there is no doubt that they were well on their way to becoming very important members of that conspiracy themselves. The role which the whole family has played since then as increasingly important insiders of this increasingly powerful and ruthless international master conspiracy needs far more detailed study and revelation than it has ever been given. But Mr. Y is certainly not the man to undertake that task for the rest of us. There is no easy way for us anti-communists to convince a skeptical public of the truth about the Rothschilds anyhow. And a book by Mr. Y might only make it a great deal harder. Because unfortunately, like Myron Fagan before him and Dr. Stuart Crane today, among many others, Mr. Y does not believe in studying any history before he starts spouting it. They seem to feel that if there is something which fits conveniently into the sensationalism they are seeking to provide, but about which they do not really know the facts, then nobody else knows those facts either, so they can say anything they want to with impunity. And they do so with such pontifical pretenses to both knowledge and wisdom as most of us would not even dream of claiming about any subject after years of studying it intensively. Actually, the matter covered in these last few paragraphs and Mr. Y's mistakes about it are not of any extravagant importance. We have taken the trouble to discuss them simply as exhibits leading up to something else. Because this whole issue of overkill is shot through with sloppy history, sloppy English, and sloppy emotionalism parading as logic. And there is one other sample of his forensic production which is of very basic importance indeed. It deals with a subject which concerns us vitally tonight. Also, while Mr. Y presents the arguments involved as if the whole theme originated with himself, he takes this erroneous history and what seem to us to be the unsound conclusions, both of which he has merely dressed up more gaudily with a few extravagances of his own, from a published book which we shall call Insurrection, by a far more scholarly writer whom we shall call Dr. X. We shall not further identify Dr. X because his book contains a great deal of excellent material on the grievances behind and the participants in the tax rebellion. And we do not want to be any more critical of him than we can help. But we did want to go on record as being aware that the following line of thought, to which we object so strenuously, was made much more serious through being backed by this more substantial author. After which interpolation, let us clarify what we are talking about by quoting the first paragraph at the beginning of page 6 in Mr. Y's pamphlet, headed by an astounding title, The Federalist Conspiracy. This passage reads as follows. The Federalist Conspiracy, and I might warn you, by Federalist, he's referring to the Federalist Papers to Hamilton, Washington, and Adams, and the Federalists of the 1780 to 1800 period. Quote, The Federalist Conspiracy is far from new, for it began even before the United States Constitution was formally ratified. One of these early conspirators was Alexander Hamilton, who we now know was an agent of the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England. For nearly 200 years, these men have had but one ambition, to establish strong central governments whose destiny they could control through the power of taxation and central banks, unquote. In other words, the long, infinitely evil movement begun by Adam Weishaupt and his Illuminati in 1776, which made its first great stride towards destroying Western civilization by playing so mighty a part in bringing on the Holocaust of the French Revolution, which has continued its ever more deadly subversive undertaking through other wars and other revolutions and other means right up to the present time, and which we ourselves have called, simply for lack of a better name, the Great Conspiracy, this most foul, far-reaching, and satanic plot in all human history has been renamed by Mr. Y, at least so far as all of its impact on the American nation and the American people is concerned, as the Federalist Conspiracy. And there then follows some 2,000 words blaming all of the evils we have suffered from that conspiracy for the last five generations on the Federalists in the days of George Washington and John Adams, and primarily on Alexander Hamilton as the one great villain of the plot and, in fact, of all American history. We find it solemnly stated, for instance, that, quote, as a result of Andrew Jackson's stand against Federalist conspiracy, his name is taught to be hated in every schoolroom in America, unquote. Or that, quote, by 1900, these Federalist forces had gained control of the United States government, unquote. And in all capitals that, quote, yet this Federalist conspiracy is so powerful today that they have kept this Liberty Amendment from even being voted on for 12 years, unquote. This is about the worst collection of half-baked nonsense that your present speaker has ever come across. all of the history advanced to support it is about on a par with the references above to Hamilton as, quote, an agent of the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, unquote. One of the many things wrong with that statement is that when Hamilton was killed by Aaron Burr in 1804, it is doubtful if the Bank of England had ever heard of the Rothschilds. And the hatred of Alexander Hamilton manifested so arrogantly here grows out of the following well-known facts. For a decade after the American Revolution got underway, the colonies had struggled along under the extremely loose-knit Articles of Confederation. Washington and John Adams and Hamilton and most other statesmen of the time wanted to convert this hodgepodge arrangement into the framework of a powerful nation. They succeeded in doing so at the convention called in 1787 for that purpose. Hamilton did more than any other one man to iron out all of the objections and disagreements and thus get the new Constitution of the United States ratified in due course by all 13 colonies. Hamilton then set out as Secretary of the Treasury under Washington as our first president and with the full support of both Washington and Adams to bring some order and stability out of the incredible financial mess in which both the separate states and the Confederation had found themselves by the time the Revolution was won and in the years immediately thereafter. The currency issued by the Continental Congress, for instance, had become so valueless that, quote, not worth a continental, unquote, has come down as a stock phrase in our language. To bring the order and stability we have just mentioned out of that chaotic situation, Hamilton badly needed, in fact had to have, and succeeded in establishing a national bank. And with it, he also succeeded in his substantive purpose of putting the new nation and its currency on a solid basis. But Hamilton's use of this bank for the great and very real need at that time was no more parallel to the establishment of the Federal Reserve System for entirely different purposes a little over 100 years later than George Washington's strengthening of the presidency and of the new government of the new nation was a part of any desire by Washington to become a king. Now, our reason for going so sketchily and inadequately into this bit of history connected with the early days of our republic is that some misinterpretation of some of that history being disseminated by some of the tax revolt enthusiasts is going to create real obstacles to any sound tax reform in this country if it is allowed to go unrefuted. And we are not talking about their incredible vilification of Alexander Hamilton, nor the even more incredible build-up and glorification of Thomas Jefferson, except as those attitudes derive from what seems to us to be a massive misunderstanding of and frightening sympathy for the French Revolution itself. But their social, political, and economic theories can constitute a very difficult obstacle to overcome in our effort or any effort to start our country moving towards a really sound policy of taxation, as we hope to make clear in the final and most substantive points to be discussed tonight. So let's return, in starting on this next stretch, to the more positive aspects of our own proposed campaign for lower taxes through less government. One, we now repeat what we stated near the beginning of an earlier section, that no such astronomical revenue from taxation as is currently being collected is actually needed at all by our federal government. One reason is the sheer, deliberate, calculated waste of money for no other purpose than getting rid of it by so many agencies of that government. Your speaker, tremendously shocked and amazed at the time, first ran into the embryonic development of this practice in the spring of 1948. At that time, I happened to hold the highest elective office in the National Association of American Candy Manufacturers and also to be chairman of its National Legislative Committee, which was actually called the Washington Committee. And so I was in constant touch with a great many government agencies, especially including the Food and Drug Administration and the Federal Trade Commission. Early in the spring of 1948, I was approached by two officials of the United States Department of Commerce. They had dreamed up a service which they wanted to perform on behalf of all candy manufacturers. It was one of those fact-finding monstrosities which, it seemed to me, would not serve any useful purpose. Nevertheless, at their insistence, I arranged to let them present it to the next full meeting of the association's board of directors. The directors felt exactly the same way as I had about this proposal, so they tried to brush it aside in a friendly manner by agreeing to take the offer under consideration. After which nothing happened, of course. But the Department of Commerce people were really persistent. They almost wore me out, urging greater positive support on my part for their project. Until finally one day I said to them, "Look, gentlemen, you know and I know that carrying out this project would cost each candy manufacturer a lot of time and therefore money, in just handling the bureaucratic requirements of this fact-finding operation without doing any of us one bit of good. Yet you are determined to allocate several hundred thousand dollars of the government's money to putting it over. Do you mind telling me why? One of them looked at the other one, who nodded, and the first one then said, quote, Mr. Welch, you have been very frank and fair with us, and I believe that we can be equally frank with you on a confidential basis. We are on a spot. As you know, the government's fiscal year will come to an end on June 30th. And in our little corner of the Department of Commerce, we have several hundred thousand dollars, which we simply must get rid of by that time. Justice must also be done by other groups in the department with extra money for which they are responsible. And unless we can all find plausible ways to spend that money, the whole department's appropriation for next year will be cut down to below what it was this year. So we are asking your help in doing our part to keep that from happening. Unquote. They didn't get it, the help. But I am sure that hundreds of different bureaucratic groups and agencies were successful in similar undertakings. I am also sure that all of the millions spent that year in this manner were just peanuts compared to the increasingly enormous sums which have been deliberately wasted on such boondoggles since then and are being wasted at still higher levels today. I know of one case some years back where the sum of $3 billion was involved. The number and the amount which could be dug out by patient research would boggle your mind. And just putting an end to this practice alone would go a long way towards making the graduated income tax completely unnecessary. Two, but that is only the beginning of the answers which can be provided to those who say to you, quote, of course we do not like the income tax, but where on earth is the government going to get the money needed to operate without it, unquote. For the real comprehensive answer, of course, is that there is no such need at all if we return to an American political and economic system instead of continuing to approach the communist system. And that point brings us at long last to the real reason why I have reluctantly dragged the tax revolt advocates into so much of this discussion. For some of them, without being at all aware of what they are doing, are really supporting communist plans. Mr. Y's mentor, Dr. X, for instance, writes in one of his books of the rising French bourgeoisie of the last half of the 18th century, quote, this economic group, however, because of its intellectual vigor, was able to accumulate considerable wealth and project a convincing revolutionary philosophy in the works of Voltaire, Rousseau, and the encyclopedists, unquote. Remember, that's the bourgeoisie he's talking about, the rising bourgeoisie in France. Further along, he says, with obvious approval, quote, in July 1789, the Paris mob attacked and destroyed the Bastille, where thousands of political prisoners had been tortured and executed. Shortly thereafter, they stormed the royal palace, known as the Tuileries. In due course, Louis XVI, Queen Marie Antoinette, and many thousands of their nobles and supporters were laid silently to rest under the guillotine, unquote. Dr. X's history, apparently, comes out of the pro-communist propaganda that has been parading his history with more and more overwhelming success, especially in Western Europe and the United States for the past 100 years. We should like to suggest that he read Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robison and the four volumes by Abbé Barrouel, both published in 1798, and then all of the exhaustively documented books of Nestor Webster published in the first decades of our own century, and scores of other books produced during the generations since the French Revolution, which noble men and women have brought out the cost of their careers and frequently of their lives. He might then learn something of the real conspiratorial origin and brutalitarian results of both the philosophy and the event which he records with so much gratification. It would be very easy, and we should like very much, to show how utterly mistaken are the interpretations of history in just the two passages we have quoted. But it would take far too much time for a fully documented exposure of the errors, falsehoods, and distortions through long-continued propaganda which have been accepted by Dr. X in just those two short passages. Especially would it take too much time to convince him or other uninformed doubters that the revolution which he is praising there was run by exactly the same self-perpetuating group of criminal conspirators that we are facing in America today, and which is right now perpetrating the same horrible murders, treason, and other crimes in Cuba and Portugal and China and so much of Africa for the very same purpose of increasing the power of this conspiratorial clique until it rules the whole population of the earth as its miserable slaves. So let's go on at once to what matters in Dr. X's book for our immediate concern. This is his horrible belief has made clear at many places throughout that book that it is the function of government to provide and ensure the welfare of its people. This is in tune, all right, with the pretenses of the conspirators who perpetrated the Holocaust of the French Revolution. It is the entire pretense and the ostentatiously claimed philosophy of all the communist tools and the actual bosses at the top of the same conspiracy today, five generations later. But it is exactly and completely contrary to what Americans have always believed and to the principles of government and of economics which enable the United States to become the best environment for human life that our poor, fumbling human race has ever reached. Dr. X and many of his impetuous fellow tax revolters do not really believe that the sole function of government is to protect the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness on the part of its citizens. He believes instead that it is the duty and function of government to provide that happiness, to provide it for them, or at least to provide all the features of a government-produced setting in which they had better be happy, by golly, or the government will send them to concentration camps. It is for this reason, we believe, accepted unconsciously and not thought through to its real significance at all by these basically good people, that their present opposition to taxes has taken such a confusing form. For on reading some parts of Dr. X's book carefully, you will find that he has no objection whatsoever to the real basis and cause of all our troubles, which is simply our permitting the government to play the role of Santa Claus. In fact, Dr. X wants the government to be Santa Claus. Dr. X merely objects to the kind of bag in which our Santa Claus currently carries his goodies. He, Dr. X, seems to have no recognition that, as Tom Anderson, among others, has pointed out so emphatically, a government which can give you everything must be in position to take everything away, to take it away from you and give it to somebody else, in accordance with the whims or self-interest of the politicians in charge of that government. Further careful reading of this best-known book today in support of a tax rebellion discloses that Dr. X does not really advocate abolition or drastic reduction of confiscatory taxes at all. He wants to reduce the upper limit of the graduated income tax to what he thinks, from his particular perspective on the economic scene, is the right level. And if the government, to provide enough goodies so that everybody at least ought to be happy, needs the revenue from the graduated income tax beyond or above what he thinks is the right level, then the government should raise that money by installing instead a nationwide retail sales tax of perhaps 10%. And we could go on for quite a while with what seemed to us to be numerous incongruities and even extreme absurdities in the come-on publicity for the tax revolt show. But that's enough, we believe, to demonstrate that Dr. X and we birchers simply do not speak the same language. We do not go all of the way with the extreme libertarians, both because we believe that some reasonable measure of government is necessary in any civilized social organization, with even some interference as to our individual rights and responsibilities, about which it is not easy to draw the line, and also because we believe that our disastrous economic developments of recent years have not been due at all to economic fallacies, but to the deliberate plans of ruthless conspirators to bring about those disasters for their own sinister purposes. We do believe very earnestly, however, that allowing any government to step materially out of its purely negative role of simply providing law and order and protection for its citizens, and to move over into the positive role and paternalistic function of being the provider of the necessities and comforts and luxuries of life, we believe that this course, unless the people have the sense and courage to reverse that trend in time, will lead inevitably to two things. A, the transformation of a land of abundance with millions of salesmen always trying to move the too much into a land of scarcity, with millions of ration clerks always trying to divide the too little. And B, a second inevitable result, the transformation of a free country into an absolute dictatorship with a merciless police force needed to maintain such tyranny. We further believe that exorbitant taxation under the pretense of thus benefiting the people is one of the most criminal and efficacious means any conspiracy can use for bringing about these transformations. We believe that we should be doing everything that is morally right and politically wise to prevent it. And this certainly does not rule out a tax revolt under all conditions at any time or all times by any means. But there are all kinds of pitfalls to be guarded against in our program as in any other. For one thing, there will be left-wing politicians by the dozen. There already are some who may have been brought out of the woodwork by the noise of a pending tax revolt, who will want to climb aboard any bandwagon driven towards tax reduction, but with a firm idea in their own minds of supplying the government even more money with even worse effects on our country through deficit spending and a higher national debt. These and similar perversions of our effort by double-crossing hangers-on must be diligently avoided. But the whole essence of our drive will be summed up in that phrase, lower taxes through less government, because reducing the power and functions and activities of government by at least 50%, which is our present goal for the foreseeable future, is even more important in the long run than stopping the pain of having our money stolen from us by agents of the conspiracy. Whatever we can accomplish in this endeavor, therefore, every tiny gain we can make will serve a double purpose and will lead to greater gains in the future. The mechanics of this project will be largely educational, of course, but they will also be reinforced by practical efforts to obtain some prompt benefits from that education. We shall start setting forth those mechanics in our July bulletin. We shall be striving not for fireworks, but steady accomplishment. As members of the John Birch Society, we shall be sustained in our effort by the knowledge from experience that to achieve so worthy and important an end, there is no easy way. But as Birches, we shall also be inspired by the conviction that it can be done. And now, my friends, we are almost through. 4 hours yet? Long enough. And now, my friends, we are almost through. Please allow us a few paragraphs, or at most a few minutes, to summarize this long dissertation. Then you can relax, at least briefly, from so many serious thoughts. We have spent a great deal of time in talking about the embryonic tax revolt, even though we expect it to become an abortion. One reason for so much attention to it is that, of course, we could be wrong, and that in any case, it is a current development of considerable importance. A second reason is that so much of the supporting literature being issued by advocates of this tax rebellion is full of such incredible misunderstanding, shallowness, and distortion of both the history and the economic principles involved. It was our intention to go into considerably more detail in this speech about their dangerous fallacy in glorifying the leadership, methods, and purposes of the French Revolution, apparently without recognizing that these were all manifestations of the very same infinitely evil and self-perpetuating conspiracy which we are facing in America today. And also to go into more details about their extremely confusing habit of giving such fulsome praise to the leading supporter of that French Revolution in our country, namely Thomas Jefferson, while condemning so violently the Herculean efforts of Washington, Adams, and Hamilton to keep Jefferson from planning both the ideas and organization of the Jacobinical leaders in the United States. But I find, to my delighted surprise, that Bill Fall has covered this ground adequately and well in his foreword to our June bulletin. So we merely urge, emphatically as we can, that all of you read that foreword to the June bulletin very carefully if you have not already done so. And we go on directly to our third and most important reason for so much conversation about the tax revolt, which is that it offered both the best and the most timely illustration we could find with which to clarify the real theme of this speech as indicated by its title. And we leave the tax revolt argument for good at last by quoting a wisecrack invented by somebody which I love to apply to myself whenever I feel an urgent need for shattering my own pomposity. The wisecrack reads as follows: the people who think they know everything certainly are aggravating to those of us who do. And after that confession, we come to the final point. It has been the contention of the John Birch Society throughout the 15 years of our existence that there is no easy way to defeat and destroy the conspiracy which seeks to make slaves out of some 97% of the whole human race. At the same time, we know that it can be exposed and scattered to the wind by our long, hard educational labors. Let's look at some recent and very encouraging signs. We are sure that our special letter-writing campaign made the difference that spelled defeat for the land use bill by a vote of 211 to 204. when that most communistic piece of legislation ever to be presented seriously to an American Congress last came up again. During recent months, our educational program has had a similar effect on the Equal Rights Amendment, on the Genocide Treaty, on any full diplomatic recognition of Red China, and on the continuing attempt of the American Indian Movement to set up one or more Soviet governments within our borders. None of these reverses are at all fatal to the conspiracy, but enough of them surely would be, and enough such setbacks for it can be accomplished with education as our total strategy and truth as our only weapon, if we will only work hard enough at the job and bring in enough new recruits to help us. This is because time and history and human nature are all on our side. The chances that we shall win seem to me today to be about even, but the chances that we can win, if we put sufficient labor, sacrifice, and resolution into the effort, are far more favorable than that. As we said on the last page of the Blue Book 15 years ago, quote, all we must find and build and use to win is sufficient understanding. Let's create that understanding and build that resistance with everything mortal men can put into the effort while there still is time, unquote. Also, my friends, it has just occurred to me that early tomorrow morning would be a very propitious occasion for each of you to get back on that job with renewed vigor and increased determination. And may God be with you till we meet again.